Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. If you go to SF MoMA right now, it's hard to miss a massive 32-foot-wide mural depicting a fantastical and futuristic vision of San Francisco. This William Scott mural opens a historic exhibition, The House That Art Built, which showcases 11 artists with developmental disabilities who are associated with the Oakland-based nonprofit Creative Growth. In addition to the exhibition, SF MoMA has also permanently acquired more than 100 works created by artists with developmental disabilities. We'll talk about the stunning exhibition, this big acquisition, and the future for artists with disabilities in the Bay Area. That's all coming up next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. The powerful movement of Bay Area people with disabilities has a history stretching back into the 1960s. Our local activists have been crucial in the creation of new paths for people to live well and live independently. Braided through that political history, there's a fascinating story of creative and artistic explorations by people with disabilities, many around here enabled by the Oakland nonprofit Creative Growth. After several decades, the work of those disabled artists is receiving greater recognition from art institutions, including a new exhibit up at SF MoMA, The House That Art Built, which showcases 11 artists with developmental disabilities. We're going to hear from several of the artists a bit later, but first we are joined by Chris Bedford, director at SF MoMA.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Tom DeMaria, executive director of Creative Growth Art Center. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Pleasure to be here today.
So, Tom, maybe let's start with you. This new exhibit is historic in several senses. Huge collection of art by artists with developmental disabilities. How did it all come together?
It all came together when Chris became the director of SF MoMA, and his arrival to the San Francisco Bay Area was prefaced by a post by a curator in New York named Matthew Higgs, who has been working with the Creative Growth Artists for many years, and made a mention to Chris that any director, San Francisco MoMA, should understand and respect and amplify the work by artists with disabilities in the San Francisco Bay Area as being an important historical, cultural, and artistic movement within the Bay Area.
Huh. Chris, had that been a pre-existing interest of yours, or was it coming into this role and coming to understand kind of the Bay Area history that brought you to it?
No, I mean, it was not a pre-existing interest at all. I've always been interested in the idea that you have a canon or a set of norms that structure museum behaviors, museum exhibitions, acquisitions, and the history that we all collectively learn. And I've been interested throughout the course of my career in taking those that canon, complicating it, diversifying it, and turning it on its head. So I have a long history of working with African-American artists, long history of working with women artists, both woefully underrepresented in the history of art. No group as underrepresented as artists working with disabilities. So I was looking for a sort of site-specific way of enacting that same mission, vision-based direction in San Francisco. I really believe in site specificity as an idea, essentially stolen from artists. Do something that feels
makes
native
sense
to
here.
Here in the Bay Area. So it was incredible to learn that this really is the center of the disability movement and has been for the last 50 years. So when Matthew Higgs, this curator that Tom mentioned, made that post, you know, my very strong feeling was this is a calling. This is a service to the community. It's a service to artists with disabilities. It's a service to our audience. We can claim this as our own, and it's something to be massively proud of. So I was completely ignorant, but have been transformed by the experience.
And now SF MoMA is also permanently acquiring, right?
I mean, right.
More than 100 pieces of work by disabled artists in the Bay Area. So how'd you choose that? How many, how did that work out?
So that's the biggest testament to an institution's belief in an artist, is the decision to move through the acquisition process. It's sort of a profound thing within a museum. It essentially says, this artist, this artwork can and should be part of art history. We want to commit it to our museum and use it to serve our public in perpetuity. So a really big and profound deal. I think when my colleague Katie Siegel, who I brought here from Baltimore, did some initial reconnaissance of Creative Growth, we were completely bowled over by the quality we saw and the consistency of the quality as expressed across the entire not-for-profit. And I think the question I wanted to answer for myself was, if I can walk up and down the streets of Chelsea in New York and see, you know, experience sort of 3% interest and 1% excitement, why is it that I walk through Creative Growth and see a sort of 70% hit rate and feel like my head is on fire? Why is that?
Have you answered that question for yourself?
Absolutely not, which is great, because it's like sand through your fingers. You know, you will just keep coming back in an effort to understand. But it was really obvious to us that we needed to make the commitment. It was obvious that we wanted to make a commitment on the historic scale to make a statement. And ideally, other, you know, museums around the country would begin to follow suit, because it really merits that attention.
That's so interesting. I had that same experience in the exhibit, actually, of just being bowled over by so many of the pieces of work. I mean, Tom, a couple questions for you. First, on that point, why for you has this work been so remarkable? Like, what do you attribute that to? Is it like a process that Creative Growth has created? Is it sort of just the vision of these artists working in their different medium?
Right. Two things. I'm going to answer that, but I also want to add to what Chris's remarks about the curatorial process, because it was a pleasure working with their two chief curators on this, Nancy Lim and Jenny Geith, in terms of 8 curatorial visits over a year as we sort of privately looked at the history of Creative Growth, the artists that were working there now, the artists that has historically worked there and were no longer alive. And how do we organize the work that we select for the acquisition? Do we take one piece by 100 artists? Do we look in a single artist who might be well known? And I think we selected work that really shows the depth of the artist practice. And I think that's very important, particularly for artists with disabilities, because the work is sometimes dismissed as not being complex, that it doesn't evolve, that there's not an intellectual engagement with the viewer. And I think looking at the groups of artists that were selected and the groupings of their work, you know, a lot of those myths are being set to the side. In terms of my engagement with the work and my response to it, in terms of often artists with disabilities are first people with disabilities who have not had cultural connection or have not had opportunities to be communicative in society or have told that they cannot be cultural participants, let alone be cultural leaders. And the Creative Growth model turns that upside down. And I think when you give people the opportunity to be creative, which is for me a fundamental human right, and to communicate, you know, the work that results from that is amazing.
Yeah. You know, we're going to hear from William Scott in just a second, a pre-recorded interview that we did yesterday. This piece, Praise Frisco, it is a massive mural. It's absolutely beautiful and colorful. And there's like a whole cosmology that seems contained inside that piece. When you look at it, Chris, like, what do you see?
There is a particular vantage point at the museum at the moment that I think encapsulates for me the vision for SF MoMA. And in a sort of single glance, you can see the signage for an exhibition of Zanelli Moholy's photography. You can see the interior of Schwab Hall, which has been adorned with this extraordinary mural by Barbara Sofica Solomon, who is a, I think, 95-year-old artist who's been really instrumental in the rise of super graphics in the world. You can see a video by Wu Sang, an extraordinary Brooklyn-based or Berlin-based Brooklyn-born video artist in our lobby. And you can see William's mural. And I think, you know, the mantra we use is we want to open as many doors to the maximum number of people at SF MoMA and be the most dynamic and relevant museum in the world doing that work. And in that glance, I see that. And William is an equal participant in creating that dynamism. So, and aside from that, I find the work incredibly moving. You talk about cosmology. I feel like he's opening up his brain and his heart with paint. Yeah. And he is that generous as a human.
Tom, can you describe just what it looks like for people who haven't seen it?
Sure. The mural or the exhibition?
The mural.
Well, I've had the privilege of working with William Scott for 25 years, and he's really a genius. And his, you know, when you see it, he's inviting you into a very private and public universe in terms of how he wants San Francisco to change. So what you will see visually is his depiction of San Francisco architecturally. So he draws the whole city and then he changes it to make it better.
Yeah.
He puts people in there that he wants to be their friends. He describes and paints the housing projects in Hunter's Point in the neighborhoods where he grew up, and he makes them better because he wants the city to be beautiful. He wants the people to be happy, to be his friends. He wants, you know, the world to be a utopian place based in San Francisco.
And I loved it. SFOs, the skyline-friendly organizations, kind of taking the citizenship. And it's kind of got a little bit of like the George Clinton mothership to it, like in terms of its style. And there's sort of these green, like happy, not quite alien ships around the city. It's so interesting.
Well, the added sort of piece of information about the citizenships and those spaceships is those spaceships are bringing dead people back to life. They are taking lives lost from drugs and gun violence and disability, and they're you know, transforming, you know, they're giving rebirth to people. Yeah. He's bringing them back to the world to have a better chance, another chance, a new life.
All right, let's get to this cut of William Scott. I asked him to describe his piece.
My artwork looks like a new city of San Francisco when renamed Praise Frisco. Because Praise Frisco is a good world to create the world on the planet. Because Praise Frisco is a good city for the gospel people.
This amazing mural that you have painted, like, what was it like to see that at the museum at SF MoMA?
They make me real feel happy. It makes me feel happy.
Why do you do art, William?
I wanted to be a good artist because I was good. I was a teenager. I was good at it when I was a teenager. I grew up being a good artist because God gave me a gift to doing a good artist. He gave me a gift.
Yeah, your art is amazing. I mean, what do you think art does for the world?
Art builds a peace on earth. It builds peace on earth.
Yeah, William, thank you so much.
That's right.
I really appreciate you, being able to come in and share a little bit of your vision with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Congratulations on your show, too, and having work in the SF MoMA.
All right, thank you.
That was William Scott, an artist with work in the exhibit at SF MoMA, The House That Art Built, just a stunning, stunning mural that opens that show. We're joined by Chris Bedford, SF MoMA director, as well as Tom DiMaria, executive director of Creative Growth Art Center. That exhibit is The House That Art Built, and it showcases 11 artists with developmental disabilities. We want to hear from you as well. Have you seen the exhibit? What'd you think? Did any piece particularly strike you? Give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about the exhibit, The House That Art Built at SF MoMA, which showcases 11 artists with developmental disabilities. The museum's also making a huge investment in acquiring pieces by disabled artists. We're joined by Chris Bedford, SF MoMA director, and Tom DeMaria, executive director of the Creative Growth Art Center. Tom, I don't know if I'm going to phrase this perfectly, but, you know, I talked to William right before I went to see, you know, the pieces in person at SF MoMA. And linguistic communication is like kind of complex and kind of difficult, I think, on both sides of that conversation. But then the creative expression, the artistic expression that you see on the canvas is just like tremendous. And I wondered, like, for you, as you have worked with people over the years, how you've come to see kind of, I guess, just language as only one piece of sort of the ability to communicate or the ability to do creative expression?
Yeah, well, the language is art and the language is creativity. And we see that again and again in the creative growth artists and in their vision and their passion and the beauty of their work. And I think, you know, often people don't quite know the questions to ask or how to have the conversations with the artists or how to get the information. And we have to approach the work not from an ableist point of view where we expect the same information from an MFA student or an academically trained artist. If you look at William's work, everything about his futurist vision is in the work. Mm-hmm. Another Life, Praise San Francisco, Gospel Town, the new son, William. He's describing and communicating everything to us that he wants us to see and believe. And we just have to look for it in the places he put it. So there's an engagement with the viewer that is required, as there is with any artwork. And sometimes we just don't have the visual literacy to understand an artist's work who's speaking to us in a different way.
Mm. You know, Creative Growth has been doing this for decades. Tell us a little bit about kind of the founding principles of this place.
Well, it's a fantastic San Francisco Bay Area story. In 1974, people with disabilities were being deinstitutionalized from California institutions. You know, if you're my age and the kid down the street had Down syndrome, they ended up in a state hospital. And we don't do that anymore. But when those people were being deinstitutionalized, there wasn't really a path forward. And our founders, Florence and Elias Katz, were a couple in Berkeley, said they, you know, she was an artist, he was a psychologist. The path forward to community engagement, to personal growth and realization, to creative growth, hence our name, is to provide art-making opportunity for deinstitutionalized people with disabilities. Mm. And they put paint on a table in their own home in Berkeley, and I'd like to say, like Apple and Hewlett-Packard, were a fantastic, radical idea from somebody's garage that is now catching on around the world, that they believed in the power of art and that the gallery is associated with creative growth, because it was always the plan, would be the portal for people, the public, to come in and meet the artists and to demystify the stigmas around disability.
Yeah.
Most people still to this day do not, you know, have a lot of people with disabilities in their community if they're not people with disabilities themselves. Mm-hmm. So we still have a lot of work to do there. But this is a really meaningful change, and we see it every day at Creative Growth. People come in, they want to meet the artists, and they have powerful, meaningful engagements.
I mean, you don't think of this as art therapy for people, do you? Or is it?
No. Everyone that works at Creative Growth, for the most part, went to art school. I have an MFA. I'm not and you don't engage in a therapeutic program if you're not a therapist. That could be very dangerous. Do not try that at home. So, you know, we believe that artists know the soul of the artist and they respect and support the process of creativity, and then that's the way the artist moves forward. By, you know, most of the artists in the SF MoMA exhibition have been practicing at Creative Growth for over 20 years. So this is not, you know, a craft workshop on Saturday afternoon where you make something and it goes on the wall. This is a deep commitment, historical and contemporary commitment to the artist practice, for them having a home, for the, you know, lifespan of their artistic work.
Yeah. Let's, you know, we also talked with another artist, Joseph Aliff, who paints abstract paintings. Can you tell us a little bit about what you see in him, Chris, or what you see in the work that's in the show?
I mean, one way to answer that is just to amplify. I'm carefully listening to Tom, who has been my sort of teacher and guide throughout the course of this. And I think he's incredibly wise in the way that he speaks about artists with disabilities. I think my strong sense is that with visual art, as in other things, the proof is in the pudding. And if you look at William Scott's work, or any other artist included in that show, it meets the criteria that I would apply to any other artist I'm considering as a major part of art history, which is to say, there's a long history of art, many doors opening, and when somebody opens a door for themselves, they walk through that door and close it for others. And history is a long progression of those moments, recognition and rupture, recognition, rupture. When I walk through that show, I see a sequence of things that I've never seen before and that cause me to think really differently about art history and its possibilities. And that's always been my criteria. I'm not so interested in listening to an artist talk about their work, to be perfectly honest. I'm interested in looking at it and the extent to which that act of beholding makes me think differently. And I sort of try to apply that to all my work in the museum, just the same way that I would apply it to the experience of music, let's say. I'm not really interested in a musician describing what he would like his music or she would like her music to do to you. I'm interested in the demonstration and the affect, the experience of it. Yeah. And I think it's self-evident in that creative growth show that it takes you elsewhere.
Yeah. Tom, for you, Joseph's work, it's really interesting. I mean, it has a ton of movement and color, and the color combinations are sort of unexpected. It's also large. It's got kind of this grand scale. What else do you see in it before we listen into it?
I think it's very lyrical and very emotional, and I think the way that I've watched Joseph kind of change the scale and the complexity of his work over the years has been fantastic. You know, Joseph works in a supermarket in the mornings, and he'd come to Creative Growth in the afternoon. And art, I think, became the way that he developed his voice. Because, you know, when you're working in a supermarket, a lot of people, you know, dismiss you whether you have a disability or not. And at Creative Growth, he became a person. And he became a person that we wanted to hear from. And I think his movement and emotional connectivity and the beauty of his colors and forms and the large abstract piece that we see in the museum is really a showstopper.
All right, let's listen to Joseph Aliff, recorded yesterday. Why do you like painting?
Just to get things out of my brain and just inspire everybody.
How does seeing your own paintings like make you feel?
Happy, proud, grateful. Just big accomplishment.
I'm going to see your mural like in about 10 minutes. What should I look for? Like the colors, the texture, the shapes?
Everything. The color, the texture, and the movement of how I used my painting, how I started it. Mm-hmm. And it's just great that the MoMA has my painting. It's just a big achievement. I'm just very grateful and honored. I feel like when people see my artwork, they will say, wow. They just gonna see, wow, it's so amazing. And I can't get over it.
That was Joseph Aliff, an artist who works with the nonprofit Creative Growth, got a pretty beautiful big mural in a big painting in the show that's up at SF MoMA called The House That Art Built. One thing I loved about what Joseph told us was is there any more pure distillation of the creative impulse than why? Just to get things out of my brain, you know? Chris Bedford, I am curious about the relationship between, I guess what, you know, it's sometimes called outsider art and this, you know, field of disabled artists. Do you see those two things as them as part of that tradition, or do you see it as a kind of a separate tradition?
I think in an ideal world, one of the reasons I came to SF MoMA, to be just to zoom way out, is to say it's one of the two biggest platforms for modern contemporary art in the country. There's MoMA in New York and there's SF MoMA here. We have a massive footprint. We have an extraordinary collection. We have a great board and we have a wildly creative staff. So the opportunity is to change the big table, change the big table of art history. So I think in answer to your question, what I would say is I am not an advocate of any of those fiefdoms. I'm not an advocate of any of those lines. I don't think it matters if a person has an MFA from Yale or has no formal education whatsoever. And I think if you look at our sequence of acquisitions, it attests to the fact that there are no lines, there are no prejudices, there's no bias. There's a view towards diversity in the broadest conceivable sense, ranging from gender to sexuality to race to relative ability. There are no lines. So for me, again, I would revert back to that point. If I'm seduced into thinking differently as a consequence of that act of beholding, it doesn't matter to me how the person got there at all.
Yeah.
So trained, untrained, outsider, insider, I think what we want to do as part of our canon formation is do away with all of that and make the table as big as it needs to be so that everybody has a relationship to art history.
Tom, for you working with these artists, did an outsider art label help or hurt?
That's a good question. Many of the historic collectors of so-called outsider art were interested in creative growth artists' work and artists with disabilities' work because it's outside the academic sort of trainings. And they looked for artists whose vision and aesthetics were more personally driven as opposed to academically driven. So there was some resonance of the creative growth work in those collections. Mm-hmm. And then those collectors lead galleries to start to present that work. And we participate annually in the Outsider Art Fair in New York, for example, because the people that are interested in non-academically trained artists often come to those venues. That said, you know, it's not a label we use. And I think for people with disabilities who are often ostracized from society, they don't need another label that pushes them more to the margins. Mm-hmm. So we're all about cultural leadership as opposed to being outside the cultural norm. Mm.
How does creative growth actually work? How is it funded? How many people work in that space? All that stuff.
It's the heart and soul of creative growth is our studio staff and artists. We support 140 artists who come to our industrial building in Oakland, California on 24th Street. If you have a person with a developmental disability can come to creative growth as an adult, become enrolled in our program, can work in that studio with supplies and materials provided for their entire life. Mm-hmm. And many of the creative growth artists have been coming for 30 and 40 plus years every day. And the team supports their aesthetic development. Mm-hmm. There's a gallery attached and the work of the artist is exhibited and sold and the public is welcome to come in and see that. And half of the proceeds from the art that's sold supports the artist and the other half supports the nonprofit. So the artists are supporters of their own nonprofit studio experience. And we have about 28 very talented staff people administratively and artistically who support our artists every day.
We're talking about the exhibit, The House That Art Built at SF MoMA, which showcases 11 artists with developmental disabilities. Mostly associated with Creative Growth Art Center. We've got the executive director of Creative Growth, Tom DiMaria, here with us. We've got Chris Bedford, SF MoMA director. We've heard from a couple of the artists as well, William Scott and Joseph Aliff. We're going to get to more of your calls and comments. Have you seen the exhibit? What did you think? Did one of the pieces particularly strike you? Or maybe you've visited or bought art from Creative Growth or artists with developmental disabilities. We'd love to hear about that piece and why it spoke to you, what it does for you. The email address is forum@kqed.org, or you can give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Tom, I did want to ask you about the sort of ecosystem of these different arts organizations that serve people with disabilities. One listener writes in to say, what's the relationship between Creative Growth and NIAID or NIAID in Richmond and Creativity Explored in San Francisco?
fabulous question. And the artists from NIAID and Creativity Explorer are also included in the SF MoMA acquisition. And so we celebrate their artists. The three centers in the San Francisco Bay Area, and there were four originally, one in San Jose that does not exist, were started by Creative Growth founders. So when Creative Growth was 10 years old, the idea was to find geographically specific or extend the geography of the artists served by Creative Growth into San Francisco and into the more into Richmond, California. So I like to say we're, you know, adult siblings of from
it's kind of like
parents.
The fruiting bodies, you know, the mushrooms for the mycelium of these founders here. Yeah, they're kind
absolutely.
Of popped
and,
up.
You know, and these centers have helped support at least 20 other similar models in the U.S. And in May, in partnership with SF MoMA this year, our fifth annual symposium of art and disability practitioners from studios like Creative Growth that come to the Bay Area. And we, you know, shop talk and we talk about artist advancement and exhibitions and strategies and supporting people with disabilities and hear from the artists. And that will be in May of this year as well. So it's, in a, you know, and we're forming a national network to advocate for our artists and the work that we do.
Oh, wow. And what do you advocate for?
We advocate for inclusion, for cultural leadership, for an end to ableism, for, you know, we're hoping that the SF MoMA acquisition will challenge other institutions to break down the barriers and create access, equal access for artists with disabilities, to not look for MFAs when they look at artists' work and the richness of their contributions.
Hmm. You know, one other thing about Creative Growth's process, I mean, these also aren't really classes, right? I mean, these are more provide like sort of the space and the permission to just create, or are there actually, you go there and there's like, here's how you paint?
No, it's not a didactic environment. So you'd come into a large studio room in a big industrial building that's organized more by media, and you'd be in a painting and drawing area, or rug making area, or a wood shop, or a ceramics area that would be sort of like organized by a staff artist who helps the artist find their own way. And, you know, all the artists in the SF MoMA exhibition, like all the other Creative Growth artists who have come our way, have often sat next to each other for 10 and 20 and 30 years, and their work looks completely different from each other. Mm. And it's really, you know, for me, that's a sign of success that we are allowing the artist's voice to come through independently. Yeah. And, you know, I think like a Creative Growth artist like Judith Scott, who's, you know, widely celebrated now, who's no longer alive, but whose work is in the exhibition, you know, she's trending. I see her work sort of being copied in academic, schools, and I don't really ever see it copied at Creative Growth. So I think that speaks to how we want the artist's voice to be unique.
And her work, right, involved kind of the winding of twine around various objects, right? So they kind of become, they almost have this like sort of mummified feel.
Yeah, and you know, the issue of biography in the field of art and disability is a complicated one. If you're interested in that, her story is amazing because she was a twin separated from her sister at an early age and institutionalized. Mm. And it's really in her 40s, deinstitutionalized, coming to Creative Growth with Down syndrome, deaf, and without language, that she started to accumulate, appropriate, steal objects and protect them and make them her own through complicated woven structures and bundling of objects that were hidden under her table at night and became amazing art objects.
Wow. Wow. Go see this exhibit and check that out with that story in your mind. It's a beautiful piece on its own, and that biographical edition is, I'm kind of stunned, actually. We're talking about the exhibit, The House That Art Built, at SF MoMA. We'll be back with more right after the break.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about the exhibit, The House That Art Built, at SF MoMA, which showcases 11 artists with developmental disabilities. Right before the break, we were talking about the artist Judith Scott. And I just wanted to give Chris Bedford, SF MoMA director, a chance to like talk a little bit about Judith Scott in the context of art history.
Yeah. So Tom pointed to the fact that the relationship between biography and creative production in the context of artists with disabilities is a troubled and complicated one. So you don't want to, I think, simply say this disability made this art possible. At the same time, every artist historically, with the possible exception of AI, you know, has and its evolving relationship, they are embodied makers with a story, with lives, with parents. And experiences that inevitably, indubitably, right, lead into the creative process. So I think in the spirit of equity of interpretation, it's really important to weave biography into the way that we understand things. Of course, then open up to a collective understanding of the formal achievement of the artist and the broader social world. But it's always micro to begin with. So I think that dimension of Judith Scott is, to me, emotionally compelling.
Absolutely. I mean, one thing I'm curious about, did she know that she had become famous at the end of her life, or did it happen, you know, posthumously?
This is always a complicated question. Judith, for the last few years that she worked at Creative Growth, had increasing numbers of visitors who came to see her and watch her work, and she sort of chuckled at them and tolerated it. She did not verbalize or have, language in the sense that we're using it today. And she would entertain or shake their hand, but then she'd push them away and go back to work. And my greatest Judith Scott story is she had an exhibition of her work in New York that was reviewed by the leading art critic of the New York Times, Roberta Smith. And I brought the review to Judith, because I always communicate with our artists, because I'm not going to make assumptions in terms of what their capacity for interest or readership is. So I gave her the article by Roberta Smith, and she put it in the sculpture and she wrapped it right in. And I thought that was like such conceptual art genius. That so buried in one of the sculptures is her take on reading her own reviews.
Wow. We're going to get to some listener comments here. Anne writes to say, my sister, Lisa Crabe, has been a creative growth artist for over a decade. Mm-hmm. It is one of the few places where she achieves something that truly makes her proud. It is transformative to have a place where her expression, which is often misunderstood in the rest of society, is celebrated. It's an amazing place.
I loved working with Lisa, and I send her sister and her family the best.
Yeah. One for you, Chris. You know, Jed writes, I have a great William Scott, the artist we were talking about at the beginning of the show, ceramic sculpture of a loving black couple given to me by the late artist Jose Ramon Lerman. It weighs a lot. Is there a way to donate the piece to SF MoMA if they were interested? And kudos to Creativity Explored for their years of amazing high-level creative output.
Absolutely. We'd be more than happy to take a look at it. I'm sure Tom probably knows the sculpture in question. You can shoot us an email and we can begin that conversation.
Yeah.
I do, and it is heavy, and I am working with the curatorial team at SF MoMA on promise gifts to the museum.
Excellent.
So they can be in touch.
Okay, wonderful. All right, so you heard it, listener out there. Couple questions about the relationship between a recent exhibit at the Oakland Museum of California, OMCA, and, you know, it was particularly notable for videos of some artists. And I think, you know, Tom in particular wants to know the extent to which this show is different from or, you know, the same as the one at OMCA.
I think that's a really brilliant question. First off, I didn't see that exhibition, so I can't intelligently comment on the content there versus the content in SF MoMA. But just to bear down on this question of video and documentation and maybe embodiment of the artist, and willingness to show, physically show the artist in the context of an exhibition. So that is a future direction of SF MoMA. I think there's a desire to differently embody, to differently tell stories around art, around different periods in art history, and to be very direct about the relationship between the maker and the thing made. I think that would be problematic if we only exercise that principle in the context of creative growth. But what we're attempting to do is do that across the board. So from Gerhard Richter to Mark Bradford to Jack Whitten to Ellsworth Kelly, treat everybody the same way as humans, as a way to increase access to the story that is art, which is a human story. So that idea of embodiment, that's very present in the Creative Growth Show. So there is an enormous mural in the exhibition depicting the interior space of creative growth. I think that's enormously important to bring the project to life.
And if I might add, I think what's particularly for me historic about the SF MoMA exhibition is it's really a celebration of the acquisition of work from the three centers. And the acquisition is historic. It really has not been done. There is no other collection, to my knowledge, in a contemporary art museum in the world that presents and now houses over 115 objects by artists with disabilities. So that is something for us all to celebrate.
Before we get back to listener calls, we have another interview that I did yesterday with Susan Jano, another creative growth artist who has a quite funny and also very interesting video piece in the SF MoMA exhibit. Let's listen. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Alexis. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, let's dive in. I mean, can you describe your video work that's in the SF MoMA exhibit?
It's a video that I did, I guess, a couple of years ago when I first started.
And what happens in the video?
It's 20 questions.
And do you answer them or do people answer them for you?
I asked them myself.
How did you feel seeing your video piece in the museum?
It was amazing.
What did it feel like?
It felt like it was an amazing feeling to do that.
What's your next goal as an artist?
I'm going to do another video.
Same kind or a different kind?
Different kind of video.
What's going to happen in that one?
It's going to be a documentary on the Katzes. It's going to be on him and his wife.
Why do you do art?
Art is my calling. I started here back in April of 2003. And when I started here, I just loved seeing everyone do it. So I just thought, okay, I'll start drawing. And that's when I picked up the drawing. And that was my calling.
What do you love about art?
Art's my favorite thing to do.
What do you think art does in the world?
Art in the world is something for people to love and get everyone in the mood.
In the mood for what?
In the mood to just see everyone doing and start loving to do.
That was Susan Jano, a creative growth artist who has a video piece at SF MoMA. Tom, do you want to talk a little bit about Susan's work?
Yeah, because Susan's primarily paints and draws on paper in these complicated and interesting sort of grid-like patterns. And then we have a digital media room, and so she joined the video group, and she wanted to make a film, so she wrote all these questions to ask the other creative growth artists and decided to film herself and ask them to herself. So it becomes this beautiful meditative sort of reflection on the meaning of life. And again, very challenging for us to understand what, existence in the world means in a way that's so compelling and unexpected.
Yeah, I found myself just standing before it, taking photos of like the different questions. I feel like that's like, I'm going to go back to those, I feel like they're all, what do you think about when you're alone? You know, if you could choose to do anything for a day, what would it be? Where do you see yourself in 10 years? I found it very therapeutic for me, just looking at.
We had it in a exhibition in a gallery or an art fair where I had to stand next to it for like 10 hours a day for 5 days. And at the end of the week, I was just like, oh my God, what does my life mean? What
is my future?
What is the meaning of life? It was amazing.
10 minutes of questions with no answers, you know? Mm-hmm. Let's bring in Elena in Pleasant Hill. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm really excited by this show today and about hearing about Creative Growth and the MoMA exhibit. I am on the board of an organization called Coach Art that provides free art and other lessons for children, sort of preschool to they age out at 19, with a whole variety of different diagnoses, some of them developmental, some of them neurological, mm-hmm. some of them physical, etc. We have volunteers that teach these children whatever it is they're interested in. And I'm really interested in maybe linking up with Creative Growth and or MoMA and exposing our students to some of what is going on there, because they have no idea the importance of their work.
Yeah, they should go. They would love it. I mean, it's a great and challenging. I mean, you know, real artists. You know, some of the work I think is probably more challenging than others for kids.
And if I can add a comment to that, I was speaking with William Scott's mother at the opening SF MoMA, and she said you have to bring the families and the young people with disabilities here, because when he was a boy, when William was young, there wasn't opportunity. There weren't any role models. There was no future. Mm. And now that exists, so we welcome our young people to visit and to be inspired by, you know, they have cultural leaders now.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that's really powerful, Tom, is, you know, I think deinstitutionalization, because of the mental health crisis that's playing out on the streets right now, I think it's almost like people have started to think about that differently. Whereas in this case, it's kind of this, it is a moment of growth and joy and freedom for so many people as presented in this history.
I hope it changes minds in terms of how individuals can, you know, be creative and be a part of cultural leadership despite their backgrounds and their circumstances. And I know that to be true. Mm-hmm. And when you come to see the exhibition, you'll learn that if you don't know that lesson.
Yeah. We're talking about the exhibit, The House That Art Built, at SF MoMA. We're joined by Tom DiMaria, Executive Director of Creative Growth Art Center, Chris Bedford, SF MoMA Director, and we've heard from three of the artists in the show, William Scott, Susan Jano, and Joseph Aliff. Love to hear from you. Have you visited the show? Have you seen it? Did any of the pieces particularly strike you? You can email us forum@kqed.org. If you've, you know, bought art from Creative Growth Artists, we'd love to hear about that piece too. You can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. Perhaps you've noticed. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We have another listener, Lindy, who writes in to say, you know, during the 90s, I regularly attended the Creative Growth Center's holiday art show as part of my own holiday tradition. On multiple occasions, I discovered without realizing it that some of the pieces I was most drawn to each year and purchased were created by the same artist, Nelson. I have two of his ceramic pieces and a wood drawing. Tom, did you get a chance to work with Nelson?
If she's referring to Nelson Tygart, I did, and his animal depictions were amazing.
Yeah, that's so cool. Where does this partnership go from here, Chris? I mean, you are going to continue to acquire these works. There's going to be a series of other kinds of events happening too, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most exciting thing about the partnership, for a start, is the education I receive from Tom every time I talk, and I'm not flattering him. I would say that to him face to face. So I find there's a selfishness to it. There's a level of self-growth that I think feeds into the growth and diversification of the institution that's really, really critical. It's absolutely a collaborative partnership. So where we go is going to be a question of where SF MoMA wants to go, where Creative Growth wants to go in conversation. Mm-hmm. I hope and trust that it's the beginning of a relationship spanning decades, way beyond Tom and I. I think if you look at the most important collections in any museum, or private collections for that matter, there are commitments that span decades. So the Fisher Collection, for instance, isn't interesting because there's one painting by Ellsworth Kelly. It's interesting because the Fishers developed a collection of Ellsworth Kelly's work spanning his entire life. I think I want to imagine at this moment, 50 years into Creative Growth's evolution, many more years into SF MoMA's evolution, that that conversation spans decades. And, you know, 100 years from now, there's a story that we can't foretell that's a consequence of this origin moment. So what's going to happen? Who knows? But I'm adamant, I'm driven to make sure it doesn't end.
That sounds great. Let's bring another call. Let's bring in Alan in Redwood City. Hey, Alan, can you hear me?
I sure can. So what I was wondering was that, do these artists have a chance to paint together so they can learn from each other and get encouraged by each other?
Yeah, that's
great. I do that when I can. I belong to the Silicon Valley Watercolor Society, and I try and paint with people who are a lot better than I, which is easy to find.
Yeah, easy for me to find, too. Thank you so much, Alan. Tom, talk to me about that.
Yeah, so for the most part, all of the artists work in a large open studio, and the sight lines are into each other's work and into each other. And that's always been the Creative Growth model and part of the plan. So the artists do work together. And I think we have to understand the richness of the community and the way that the artists become, you know, have deep friendships with each other and understand and support each other's work, how we advance the artists into curatorial decisions, how they present their work to each other and learn how to make artist statements for the museum, how to describe and discuss their own work and how to respond to each other's work. It's a real artistic community.
Do you think they get influenced by each other? Like, have you noticed over time that there's particular schools within the Creative Growth set of artists?
In my opinion, I don't think they get influenced stylistically by each other. I think they get influenced by each other to have, like, the strength, the vision to be bold and to do what they want and to not, you know, feel limited and to really experiment. So I think they the ethos is part of the experimentation more than it's a stylistic copying.
Yeah. Tom, do you know what the future for William Scott's mural is?
Yeah, I'm talking to SF MoMA curators about that. And I know that, I don't know if Chris knows that, but we hope that, that will approach him about that. You know, originally that mural was supposed to be painted right on the wall of the museum, but because of transportation and other issues, we had large panels come to Creative Growth, and he painted it over a period of 5 months. And now it exists as an object, and there's no better home for it than at SF MoMA.
I'm enthusiastically aware, Tom.
Thank you.
It's such a stunning piece of work. Every photo of it on my phone is just like popping out of there. The colors are so bright.
To be in San Francisco, it needs to record the history of this moment. It needs to record the 50 years of Creative Growth. It needs to...
And encourage the growth of SFOs, as far as I'm concerned, you know.
Yeah, and like, you know, a young kid with disabilities growing up in a marginalized neighborhood in San Francisco without cultural opportunity, having that mural in the museum, and that's like, you know, that's what are the odds of that, other than a billion to one? It needs to be there.
We've been talking about the exhibit, The House That Art Built, been joined by Tom DiMaria, Executive Director of the Creative Growth Art Center. Thanks so much for joining us, Tom.
Oh, my pleasure.
Also been joined by SF MoMA Director Chris Bedford. Thank you so much.
Such a pleasure.
Earlier, we heard parts of my interviews yesterday with three of the Creative Growth artists in the MoMA exhibition, William Scott, Susan Jano, and Joseph Aliff. Do yourself a favor. Go see this exhibition. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera.
Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Did you ever wonder what it's like to live alone, hidden in the woods, not speaking to a single soul for 30 years? Or wander the desert, uncover a hidden well, and dive to the bottom of the deepest water hole for 2,000 miles? The Snap Judgment Podcast takes you there with amazing stories told by the people who live them, with an original soundscape that drops you directly into their shoes. Snap Judgment. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.